thanks. It's great to be with all of you. Lots of familiar faces and some unfamiliar ones. I have a handout, which we won't get to immediately, but which there will be a quiz on in about 20 or 25 minutes. So my understanding is that I need to talk for about 10 or 15 minutes to introduce Flannery O'Connor to you, and then we're going to look at some passages from texts for until about the half-hour mark, and then we open up the floor and the really good part begins. So I'll try to be fast with this. So I said Flannery O'Connor's habitus, and I did that for two reasons, or in an attempt to capture a little bit of a wordplay idea. As some of you may know, habitus is a hot word in sociology these days, and thanks to theorists like Bourdieu, but it also has a longer heritage in the theological tradition, especially of Catholicism. And I really want to invoke, in general, the idea that with Flannery O'Connor, we have someone who really did cultivate a certain structure of mind, that she did cultivate, in fact, and that she thought herself, understood herself to be doing that self-consciously, in her prayer life, certainly, but we know best chiefly in her fiction writing. So she understood herself to be, in writing her fiction, cultivating a kind of habit of the intellect, as it were, in the Thomistic sense. Now, her Thomas is Maritain's Thomas, toward expressing something that she understood to be true about the divine. This was important to Flannery O'Connor because Flannery O'Connor, as you may know, grew up in Georgia in the Deep South and perceived herself, probably rightly, to be in quite the minority. She has a wonderful line in one of her letters where she says the Orthodox Catholic in the Protestant South is in a particularly favorable position to see the perversities of humankind. She was not an ecumenist. She meant that to be funny, by the way. Not that you should have laughed, but just she thought it was funny. But she understood herself to be a minority, and she understood herself throughout her life to be misunderstood as a fiction writer. And her defense, her habitual defense, if you'll forgive a pun, was that her understanding of the artist's work as a Catholic was that you had to do what expressed the gift God had given you. And she thought that's what she was doing in her fiction. And she was unabashed about that. Her fiction was embarrassing to her family and friends. It was difficult for people to understand. If you've read at all in her letters, The Habit of Being is the great collection that Sally Fitzgerald did, but they're also in the Library of America as well. You know that not only her family, but professors of English and students and psychiatrists and the like wrote to her about her stories in ways that exasperated and bedeviled her. She felt she was misunderstood all the time. Now, if you read her stories, it's not particularly hard to understand why they did puzzle people, because they're stories that have violence in them. They're stories that are laceratingly difficult and funny at the same time and really vex readers. And that's one of the things I want to talk about with you tonight. But she understood herself to be writing out of her God-given talent and to be cultivating and expressing that, and in doing so to be acting faithfully and expressively as a Catholic artist. So that's just a kind of overview of what habitus means. A little bit about her life. She lived from 1925 to 1964. As I said, she was born in Georgia. She was raised initially near Atlanta. Her father died when she was in her early teenage years she was not told us at the time, of lupus erythematosus. Some of you may know lupus is a degenerative neurological disease. When she was herself 21, well, 24, she was diagnosed with lupus herself. That telescopes some things, but it's worth noting that the illness takes its name from lupus wolf because it has a tendency to sharpen and distort the features, especially of the face. And so people who had lupus developed very pointed features and had constricted movement and whatnot. This is before many of the drugs we have now that help people control lupus better. The only treatments for lupus when she had it were blood transfusions and cortisone. And so if you see pictures of Flannery O'Connor, you can always tell when her lupus is acting up because her face is really puffy from the cortisone, in effect. But that telescopes something, but I want to have that on the table in part because Flannery O'Connor regarded her lupus as a gift from God. And when I tell you a little bit more about the story of her life, you'll understand how it fits into that. She was, by all accounts, and her own, an odd child. From very early in her life, I love this picture. This is a picture of her in her youth. Maybe we should just pass this around. I would like to have that back, but it's no big deal. Just, but anyway, she drew from the age of two or three assiduously, all kinds of things. She didn't write very much when she was younger, and she thought when she was a girl that she would be a cartoonist when she grew up, or some kind of artist. And she liked to draw satirical portraits of people. As she got older, she read a great deal, and she would write very funny things in her book, like little comments, like she read Louisa May Alcott, and she said, excellent story, thrilling characters, and things like that. You know, she was a wry child and an unusually kind of literary child. She went to college, which, in 1943 was an unusual thing in Georgia for a young woman. And she studied journalism and the liberal arts at the Georgia State College for Women. And while she was there, she really began to write, and to write in a serious way. And she decided when she graduated that she would leave Georgia and that she would get out and see the world. She had never left the state in her life at that point. And she applied to and was admitted to the University of Iowa. And she went there not to study creative writing, but to study journalism. But she'd been there about 2 weeks, and she decided she was in the wrong program. And there's a wonderful story. Now, you may know the University of Iowa's Writers' Workshop was probably the first and arguably one of the greatest writers' workshops. And at that time, it was the elite place. And a man named Paul Engel ran it. And Paul Engel tells the story of the young woman from Georgia who came into his office and handed him a letter she had typed and a manuscript. And the letter said, I am here as a journalism student, but I think I should be in creative writing. May I take your seminar? This is a story. And he read a story, what we now know as The Geranium, and by the end of the story, he knew she should be in the seminar, and he said, come to the class tonight at 6 o'clock. So she came to the class, and he wanted her to read her story, and it wound up he had to read it because they couldn't understand her accent. And that began a process of education for Flannery O'Connor, which really transformed her. Engel put her on a kind of reading program that she hadn't been on. She read a lot of modern fiction she'd never heard of before. She became socialized. Give you an idea, there are people like Robert Lowell and Catherine Ann Porter, people who are in the American literary canon are young authors at this point there at Iowa. It was a kind of a socialization and educational experience all at once for her. At the same time, she remains a bit of an outcast in the group because religion is not something that many of them care about. Lowell is a lapsed Catholic and overtly so. Porter is a skeptic, et cetera, et cetera. But she continues to practice. She goes to mass with the staff and things like that, and she's regarded as someone they love and care about, but different in certain ways. So she's negotiating this interesting position of still being a Catholic, but in a context where she's not, she's still learning how it is to be a writer and understanding those two things for her to be very closely linked, even though her social situation does and doesn't feed it explicitly. Now, implicitly, she thinks it does. She finishes her MFA. Her MFA thesis, We Should All Have Such Great Exercises, is essentially two-thirds of the collection that became A Good Man is Hard to Find. She was a perpetual reviser, so they're a little different, but they're pretty good stories even at that point. And she got a scholarship to go to Yaddo in New York State, which is a writer's colony, and which is a very prestigious deal. And she imagined herself becoming a writer in New York. That's what she wanted to do. But at Christmas in 1951, on the way home to Atlanta, she was struck with what turned out to be lupus. And while she tried to go back and live in Connecticut with Robert and Sally Fitzgerald, you may know Robert Fitzgerald, the translator of Homer, and Sally Fitzgerald wound up editing the letters and whatnot. And despite the effort, she couldn't live on her own, and she had to go back to Milledgeville. Her mother moved to a farm there, set up a room for her on the first floor. This is the house. If you want to take a look at it there, you can go visit it. They'd like you to give money because it needs to be rehabbed. That's another thing altogether. And she lived the rest of her life in that house, basically. Now, she traveled, and among other things, she came to the University of Chicago in 1963 and read A Good Man is Hard to Find. So she got around a little bit. She corresponded widely with people. We have close to 1,000 letters. She wrote 31 stories. She won 4 O. Henry Awards. She published 2 novels. She reviewed a lot of books. This is less known until recently. I've found about 100 reviews. Some of them are collected, but there's more than that there. So she was very busy, but her life was very constricted. She would get up in the morning. She would go to mass with her mother. She would come home. She would write for 2 hours, and then she would collapse. She was just exhausted, and she would sleep through the middle of the day. She would have lunch, and in the afternoon she would socialize a bit. Sometimes people would come to see her. She'd write letters, she'd read. She'd have dinner, she'd go to bed, get up the next morning and do it again. And she came to regard this as a gift from God, because she said, what has been done to me is my vocation was focused. I need to write about what I know, and what I know is here. And so she regarded this disease, which everyone else regarded as this hideous, awful thing, as being a gift. Now, Flannery O'Connor's relationship, especially with her mother, is a difficult one. And there are people who think, and I don't think they necessarily have to be wrong, that in addition to regarding it as a gift, she regarded it as a way to drive a kind of an independence for herself vis-a-vis her family. Because her family tried to hide the fact that she had lupus from her, as they did with her father. And so she began to insist on talking about it and being very open about it in ways that seemed unseemly to her family, just as her fiction seemed unseemly to them. So you can begin to see the local dynamic that was so important for her. But the consequence of that, though, is that over the next 13 years, she produced all this literature. Now, my own opinion, and reasonable people can disagree about this, is that she's probably one of the 5 or 10 greatest people ever to write short stories. I think she's a failed novelist myself, but that's a debatable proposition. She wrote 2, Wise Blood and The Violet Shall Bear It Away, and she struggled to write novels. But what is true is she didn't struggle to write stories. She could write a story in 2 or 3 days. There it is. Took her 6 years to write Wise Blood, 7 years to write The Violet Shall Bear It Away, and she was never happy with them. And that's important for our conversation, because I actually think her habitus and her notion of theology was better served by short stories than by longer fiction. And I want to talk a little bit about that, and then I'll turn to the passages that I'd like for us to talk about. O'Connor is deeply and fundamentally a sacramental theologian. And it's interesting, one of the things that I'm arguing about O'Connor in this book that I'm struggling to finish is that she was driven in this by nothing other than the Baltimore Catechism, which is a book that she read closely and carefully. There's a wonderful time in 1962, the Christian Century magazine wrote to 50 authors to say, what are the 10 most important books you've ever read? And they wrote to Flannery O'Connor, and she wrote back, and number one was the Baltimore Catechism, which I've always thought was a bit of a goad at the Christian Century. But she read it carefully, and if you read her letters, especially her letters to Betty Hester, the correspondent, who converted as a result of their letters and then deconverted, as it were, you can literally lift phrases from the Baltimore Catechism directly out of it. Now, what that means is that she's a sacramental Catholic in the sense that the world is understood to be suffused with the grace of the creation and can be understood as presenting signs of the divine and indeed signs that sometimes participate in that reality. And that's how she understood it. In other words, Thomas and Maritain, in my view, are most important for her notion of habitus. But her theology of grace is really from the Baltimore Catechism, which is Thomistic to some degree, but it's a very kind of programmatic notion. She was convinced that if it was true that the sign could participate in the reality, it would have to be disruptive in some way. And so fiction that was going to present that powerful witness of the sign participating in the reality would in some way be violent, it would be both grotesque and hilarious, and it would be very local. And if you look at her short stories, those things are always in play. So that for her, God's grace is a very specific and local thing. It literally upsets every expectation we have, and it is rupturing. Now, her stories are, and this is where the difficulty with her readers comes in, her stories are at one and the same time highly realistic. We were talking about fantasy before, and it's interesting that Michael would bring this up, because I've read her stories, and some of you may well be from the South, but I've read her stories from people who live in the South, and they say, boy, she's got it right. I mean, I've never met a person from Georgia who doesn't say, oh, you know, that's my state. Yes, I know these people. I know Red Sammy and Good Man is Hard to Find. I know Mrs. Greenleaf. I know Ruby Turpin, et cetera, et cetera. And the language and all that. So she worked very hard to capture the local environment, to the point where she was not particularly attentive to political and social niceties about race, about class, about ethnicity. She was much more concerned to capture how people talked and how they thought. But she also, at the same time, is writing stories that at a certain point, and it's that point I'd like to talk about with you all, especially tonight, something happens that just blows that up in some way, that just completely upsets that, that turns it on its head, that transforms it. And she thought that was the moment of grace. That was the moment when God entered the world and indicated what was really true. And that moment, as depicted, has forests that exhale deeply and suns that glower. You know, the supernatural takes over and the realism goes into the background, in effect. And it's this kind of relationship between these two things that are negotiated at the ends of her stories and that I think are the most interesting things and the most compelling things about them. So, that by way of just an introduction. Let me ask before we go to them, how many of you have read Good Man is Hard to Find? Just, it doesn't matter. Okay. How many have read Greenleaf? Great. And Revelation? The baby hasn't? the baby's hand is up. That's great. I love it. Okay, well, very good. Clannery O'Connor at that age, my mother would shudder. My mother said to me, why couldn't you write about someone nice like Eudora Welty? Anyway, I've never had a good answer for that. So anyway, what I thought I would do is I would read the end of each story and then invite people to comment a little on what they see in them vis-a-vis these themes. And then we could have some discussion in general terms. Does everybody have a copy of this? Anybody? Are we set up on this front? Do we need to share to make sure people have them? Are you folks settled over there? No? Here. Can you send this one over to them? Yeah, and I'll go from the book because I think I remember.
I guess because you give them that French.
Also, someone's the only one I have.
Okay, so let's do Good Man is Hard to Find first. Jesus was the only one that ever raised the dead. The misfit continued, and he shouldn't have done it. He'd thrown everything off balance. If he did what he said, then it's nothing for you to do but throw away everything and follow him. And if he didn't, then it's nothing for you to do but enjoy the few minutes you got left the best way you can, by killing somebody or burning down his house or doing some other meanness to him. No pleasure but meanness, he said, and his voice had become almost a snarl. Maybe he didn't raise the dead, the old lady mumbled, not knowing what she was saying, and feeling so dizzy that she sank down in the ditch with her legs twisted under her. I wasn't there, so I can't say he didn't, the misfit said. I wish I had have been there, he said, hitting the ground with his fist. It ain't right I wasn't there, because if I had have been there, I would have known. Listen, lady, he said in a high voice, if I had have been there, I would have known, and I wouldn't be like I am now. His voice seemed about to crack, and the grandmother's head cleared for an instant. She saw the man's face twisted close to her own as if he were going to cry, and she murmured, why, you're one of my babies. You're one of my own children. She reached out and touched him on the shoulder. The misfit sprang back as if a snake had bitten him and shot her 3 times through the chest. Then he put his gun down on the ground and took off his glasses and began to clean them. Hiram and Bobby Lee returned from the woods and stood over the ditch looking down at the grandmother who half sat and half lay in a puddle of blood with her legs crossed under her like a child's, and her face smiling up at the cloudless sky. Without his glasses, the misfit's eyes were red-rimmed and pale and defenseless-looking. Take her off and throw her where you throw in the others, he said, picking up the cat that was rubbing itself against his leg. She was a talker, wasn't she? Bobby Lee said, sliding down the ditch with a yodel. She would have been a good woman, the misfit said, if it had been somebody there to shoot her every minute of her life. Some fun, Bobby Lee said. Shut up, Bobby Lee, the misfit said. It's no real pleasure in life. So you can't imagine why anybody would have trouble with that, and, you know, or why her mother would be troubled. What do you think is the crystalline moment when everything comes together there? What's the moment of grace? Longer than you can. No.
Perhaps the recognition where she sees in him one of the children that reaches out to touch him.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't you think? That's it. And what does that? What happens then? She gets killed, right? Yeah. And she gets her epitaph from the man who killed her. And, I mean, I heard a few people chuckle, and Flannery O'Connor's heart was gladdened, those of you who did, because that line's supposed to be very funny. And funny in the way that her lines are, right? Which is to say, funny, ha-ha, oof, right, at the same time. No, really, I mean, it's... So that's the... When I say grotesque and humor at the same time, that's exactly what I mean, right? So what about it? What do you think the dynamic is there? Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's actually what I struggle with.
Yeah.
Connor, is
yeah.
really, okay, because I understand this grace to me. You can kind of be like, oh, that's the grace moment. Yeah. But why is it grace?
Yeah.
Like, why, what is, like, that recognition? And
yeah.
then,
yeah.
like, what is that tension there?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're telescoping the story, and part of what you have to understand is that this grandmother has spent the whole story playing with social conventions that have led her family to be killed. I mean, the people in the woods that she's going to be thrown to are her son, her daughter-in-law, and her three grandchildren. And they ran it first. They ran into the misfit because she led him on a wild goose chase, and secondly, they're dead because she identified the misfit when he, you know, when he wasn't known to any of the rest of them. So part of it is that this woman who has been addled throughout the story, who thinks she's in control but isn't, suddenly has a moment of love for another human being. Now, the moment of true love, as opposed to all the other things that have happened. Now, the other problem is she loves the most despicable person in the story, right? So part of the moment of grace is that the person who is most responsible for the travesty of the situation has the insight, and she has it about the person who is the agent of the devastation. That's so I can't imagine why you'd have trouble with that. But you know, that's what O'Connor is trying to think about. Remember what we said, that for her, if we're going to be serious about grace in the world, it's going to turn everything upside down. And you know, the person who is most confident that they're in charge of things is going to turn out to be least in charge. And the person who's most objectionable is the person who's most likely to say things that are true. I mean, the misfit reacts the way he does when he shoots her, in part because he sees what she's done. Because what she's done is she's loved him even though she doesn't know if Jesus was raised from the dead. For him, everything is, I got to know this. If I knew it, I'd be good. Well, she was good, and she just said before that, as you recall, maybe he wasn't raised from the dead. Why, you're one of my children. That's horrifying to him. Because what that says to him is it doesn't really matter whether you know or not, you got to be good. And what's he said? No pleasure, meanness. Well, so that's one way to exegete it, I think. Now, I really like the reaction to that, by the way. The last thing I want to suggest is this is easy or anything, but you know, to cut to the chase, something like that is what she wants us to think about. If we're serious about the gospel, this kind of thing makes a certain sense, is what she's saying. That's her argument. Yeah?
Isn't there a touch, too, where, I mean, as I remember the story, she dresses herself very neatly in case she's found dead on the highway. Everyone
she does.
She's a
yes.
lady.
Oh, no. Yeah.
So,
that's right.
I mean,
that's
the
right.
notion that, okay, there's...
I'm sorry. I've read this enough times. I think it's hilarious. But anyway,
no,
I think it's great.
So
it but it isn't. But it is. At one and the same time. Yeah.
And he's the
exactly.
misfit, so he belongs to this, all, in a sense, this other crap of misfits. And
that's right. That's right.
It turns out that, okay, her her role can be almost perfectly conventional. I mean,
uh-huh.
almost in the same way that dressing yourself is the way it is.
Yeah.
And but in a sense, his theology is fairly precise. I mean,
yeah.
if he did this, you have, discipleship is the only real response.
Yeah.
And if he didn't, what does it matter?
And he's going to reject discipleship.
And, but in a sense, what has her discipleship really been?
Yeah. Well, and what he says about her is totally true, right? I mean, she's got to have a gun to her head to say something true, which is appalling, but the case. Yeah. Any other thoughts about this? I feel like I'm corrupting the young, I'm sorry. Or Flannery O'Connor is, I guess. Anyway.
The prophet who's denying his calling. The bad ones are always the ones who they're obsessed with Christ. They're obsessed with the call of the gospel and resisting it. Right.
Yeah.
So, like,
Hazel Motes certainly is.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So in the novels, they're very prominent.
Yeah. So I mean, it's sort of a preview of that sort of motif.
Yeah, I actually think it's her most powerful expression of it, right there. Yeah. You know, Hazel Motes is he wants to form the church without Jesus Christ, which is very funny, but he hurts himself. But anyway, Michael, I'm sorry.
No, at all. It's interesting that the grandma is, in some respects, I mean, she reaches out in an act of love to this individual.
Yeah.
And so in some respects, you're almost expecting the misfit to be somehow transformed or changed. But you don't see that. You instead see a person who is the medium of grace, but who's transformed by that grace, right? And a grace that is in some respects rejected by the individual she reaches out to, and yet that grace completely, you know, she would have been a good woman if she had a gun up to her for the entirety of her life.
Yeah, go ahead.
We could almost say that the medium of grace is the mystic. He's the one holding the gun. The gun is what gives her grace to say what's true. And that's what I think is strange, is that the grace has to arrive violently in this way.
Why is that strange?
Why can't... why does grace have to have this manifestation of the physical world that's violent in that way?
Why not? Really, I mean, part of the brief here is, and this I think is much underestimated in Flannery O'Connor, is a brief against the domestication of sacramental theology. It's a brief against, and this is strong stuff, but you know, Flannery O'Connor, I mean, she is often adopted by more conservative Catholics for reasons I understand, but she's got a pretty radical vision of sacramentality. I mean, she's very skeptical about the institution of sacramentality. She thinks it's domesticated and made cheap. And part of the point of the story is to say, listen, guys and gals, this is what it is. It is hugely disruptive. And, you know, we should be very clear about that. Now, you know, she's not knocking the sacraments or anything, but she's worried about the degree to which grace has been cheapened in some sense by repetition. That's part of the answer to it. Whatever you think of it, I think that's what she was pushing at. I'm sorry, you were going to say something.
No, I was just going to say, like, for me, what really sticks out in this passage in particular is the misfit's reaction to grace, is that the reaction is what's violent.
Yeah.
And there's a sense in which that shows how powerful that grace moment is, like, for both the misfit and the woman, is that, like, the only way for him to react is to either be a disciple or to kill her right the second, because it's, like, his shooting her is a way of, him, like, showing that he's touched in a way, right? But, like, the grace, she touches him, and it's he has to react one way or the other.
Words are cheap.
Right.
Touch is not. And remember how he's dressed at this point. He's wearing her son's shirt, which one of the others has brought back. So she's talking to her son. And her son has red-rimmed eyes and thinks there's a lot of recapitulation.
And her son rejected her, right? Because the point where when she recognized the misfit, and the misfit says, it would be better for all of you to have done that.
Yeah.
And he used a word that shocked even the children.
Even the children, those charming children, John Wesley and June Starr, who the monkey runs away from. I love that. Anyway, that's right. Go ahead.
Okay, so what I'm looking at is there's this recognition, and that's graceful. But then he becomes a murderer.
He does.
So, right? So there's a transgression.
Absolutely, it's a transgression.
So how do we say that that's graceful?
Well, because it recapitulates what happens on the cross, perhaps. Right? I mean, the one who came and touched people and transformed them and recognized them as brothers and sisters was crucified for it. The misfit has the integrity of knowing what the Christian vision means. And he rejects it in the only way it can be rejected, which is to try to kill it, would be the answer, I think. You know, that seemed to make you very happy. Well, I think that's what she would say, anyway. You know.
Yeah, go ahead. I still don't see how the sort of violent vision of grace doesn't crowd out a theology more focused on the sacraments as vehicles for grace.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine a Flannery O'Connor story about Catholics. I just can't imagine that.
Well, the Temple of the Holy Ghost is. Why not?
Something about it, because grace always has to arrive in these violent ways, and it seems like there would be no place in a Flynn or O'Connor's story for grace coming through, like, the Eucharist.
Oh, no. You should read The Displaced Person, which I thought about having us read tonight. But, I mean, The Displaced Person is an interesting story because arguably the central dynamic figure is a priest. And while I think the priest gets some things comically wrong, he is the agent of grace. But she's not interested in replicating sacraments per se. No, she's not. And she does have, as far as I can tell, a much broader audience among Protestants than Catholics, actually. It's an interesting thing. So there's something to what you say. But I don't think she wants to leave him out. But again, it also is, she's writing what she knows, and what she thinks she knows is the Protestant South. That's what she thinks she knows. So, you know, there's a certain discipline here. I'm going to write about what I know. Okay, so. Why don't we move to the second one? Because one of the things I want to be careful about not... I mean, she iterates this, but it develops. And one of the things I want you to watch as we go through them is to look at what changes in the next two, because a couple things do. And the next one is Greenleaf. So give me a second to find Greenleaf. Farther along. Here we go. And let's talk about it after we read its ending. And I start within a few minutes? Good. Great. In a few minutes, something emerged from the tree line, a black, heavy shadow that tossed its head several times and then bounded forward. After a second, she saw it was the bull. He was crossing the pasture toward her at a slow gallop, a gay, almost rocking gait, as if he were overjoyed to find her again. She looked beyond him to see if Mr. Greenleaf was coming out of the woods too, but he was not. "Here he is, Mr. Greenleaf," she called, and looked on the other side of the pasture to see if he could be coming out there, but he was not in sight. She looked back and saw that the bull, his head lowered, was racing toward her. She remained perfectly still, not in fright, but in a freezing unbelief. She stared at the violent black streak bounding toward her as if she had no sense of distance, as if she could not decide at once what his intention was. And the bull had buried his head in her lap like a wild, tormented lover before her expression changed. One of his horns sank until it pierced her heart, and the other curved around her side and held her in an unbreakable grip. She continued to stare straight ahead, but the entire scene in front of her had changed. The tree line was a dark wound in a world that was nothing but sky, and she had the look of a person whose sight has been suddenly restored, but who finds the light unbearable. Mr. Greenleaf was running toward her from the side with his gun raised, and she saw him coming, though she was not looking in his direction. She saw him approaching on the outside of some invisible circle, the tree line gaping behind him and nothing under his feet. He shot the bull 4 times through the eye. She did not hear the shots, but she felt the quake in the huge body as it sank, pulling her forward on its head, so that she seemed, when Mr. Greenleaf reached her, to be bent over whispering some last discovery into the animal's ear. Now, a little background about this for those of you who haven't read it. The she is Mrs. May, who runs a farm. And the very opening of the story, she wakes up in bed because this bull is outside her bedroom window. And she goes and she tells the bull to go home. And throughout the story, the bull is courting her, in effect. So the heroic love imagery of the bull at the end is intended, and with all the Freudian accoutrements, I think, just to name that in effect. But what do you see here? What's the moment here, do you think? A little tougher, isn't it? It's interesting. It gets harder. Any guesses? Anybody want to? I'm not sure myself, to tell you the truth. I think there are some candidates. Mr. Baylor, are you going to say something, or are you just breathing deeply? I can't tell.
I have an idea, but I'm afraid to say it.
Why are you afraid? We're all among friends. What do you think it is?
I was going to say, at the moment, one of his horns sank until it pierced your heart.
Yeah. Pierced her heart. What about that?
Oh, actually, the mind continuing, and the other curved around her side and held her in an unbreakable grip.
Yep. It's a good candidate. Yes, sir.
So when that happens, the scene changes. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the changes, because I don't know if we get a description of the scene before. It's like sort of...
Oh, yeah. Well, she's out in a field surrounded by woods. What's happened is Mr. Greenleaf is her... I'm sorry, but... Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, part of it is simply that, right, she's been lifted up by the bowl,
yeah.
So now her sight is not on the trees in front of her, but mostly sky.
Yeah.
So that what's below her
yeah.
is sort of, like, when she says...
Her angle of vision has changed.
Right, her angle of vision has physically changed, but that's obviously...
But she still sees Mr. Greenleaf come up, even though she doesn't see him. That's
right.
One of the interesting things, right?
Right.
And she hears the shots, but she can't feel them, but she can tell the body moved by them. I mean, there's a lot of displacement of sense experience that takes place here, to say the least. The sky opens up, it's transformed. All right. Yeah. What's that all about? What's happened to her?
It's an experience of mystical union. I mean,
yeah.
Even the sort of erotic yeah. description is similar to a lot of mystical accounts
yep.
of beatific vision.
Yep. Yep.
And certainly the bowl... has served as a symbol of the divine. I mean, Zeus transforming into the bull as a means of courting maidens.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's interesting to have that sort of erotic element of
yeah.
the bull already present just in the figure of the bull itself.
Yeah. And we could connect the bull up with the misfit, perhaps? Mm-hmm. Yeah, please.
Well,
go.
I always thought that the bull was more like a symbol of nature,
mm-hmm.
or like, so, I mean, like the idea of the Minotaur being like half man, half or like half like, I don't know, uncontrollable nature and half.
Yeah.
Like, man, I don't know. I mean,
you do
read
know.
This
don't.
Story.
Don't. No, it's great. Keep going.
I haven't read this story, so
mm-hmm.
I don't know what her disposition is before this.
Uh-huh.
Excerpt, but it seems like it's a real encounter with nature.
There's no question that the bull is a force, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, to give you an idea of one way this story is read, I've had people tell me that the bull is the Catholic Church, and I'm not sure I would go that far, but the idea is that the bull will grab your heart and embrace you, right? And that it's just going to, it's a force that's going to do that eventually, and it's going to, you know... And I don't know if we want to go that far with this. I would personally, although it's an interesting reading of it, in effect, it's a very strong allegorical reading of it. But the mystical thing is absolutely right. There's no question. She is made into a mystic by this bull. There's no doubt about it. And that's so whether the bull is the church or something else, the bull is, without question, the instigator of the sacramental exchange. She is heading to union with God, and we're given a look at it. Now, do we get that with the grandmother?
Pardon, do we get what?
Do we get that with the grandmother?
The mystical union.
Yeah, the mystical vision.
Yeah.
No, we don't.
Well, as she's laying back, she's smiling.
Yeah, but do we see what she sees? No, we don't. We're just told. So part of the movement here is, whereas we're told the grandmother is looking up, here we see through the eyes of Mrs. May, and we're told something of what she feels. And the misfit does play the role of the bull. He kills her and delivers her, as it were, to God, in effect. But it's a bull, not a misfit. The bull doesn't talk, right? And the aftermath of it, and in its own way, it's meant to be just as funny as the misfit's line about, you know, she'd have been a good woman, is she's been trying to get Mr. Greenleaf to kill that bull for the whole story, and he is beautifully adroit at avoiding doing that. I mean, he's a classic hand on a farm who is not going to do, he's not going to kill the bull, but he does at the end once it's killed her. Four shots, bam, 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 bam. She's been trying to get one for the whole story without luck, and now, wow, there we go. You know, so in some sense, the comedy is meant to still be there in that, as awful as it is. I mean, I don't mean to diminish anybody's sense of kind of the grotesquery and outrage of it, but that's meant to punctuate it with some humor. It's like he finally does what she's wanted him to do all along. Yeah, go ahead. I saw a hand down here somewhere. No? Oops. Oh, Michael.
Well, it's earlier in the story as well, it talks about how they had been intending to turn the bull into beef for some time and
mm-hmm.
then it escaped.
Yeah.
And also early in the story, when she hears the word Jesus, she says, "Oh well," she gets uncomfortable because Jesus is the type of word that should stay inside churches.
Yes, indeed. Right?
So there's very much the domestic, the effort to tame or to domesticate certain realities.
Well, that's a beautiful point. And related to that is she's a very neat woman. And she's really appalled one day when she's out looking for the bull and Mrs. Greenleaf is in the woods. And Mrs. Greenleaf cuts out all the traumatic experiences from the newspaper and puts them on the ground and rolls on the ground moaning in empathy with them. And she is just repulsed by this. You know, so she likes everything in its place, including her religion, in effect, as Michael says. And part of what's happening is that her likes are being totally upended here, right? But she gets the mystical vision. She gets to God. And, you underestimate at your peril how important it is for Flannery O'Connor that people get to God. That's the whole story. You know, how you get there is much less important to her than that you get there. And the problem that she's worried about is the degree to which we tend to worry too much about how we get there and not enough about getting there, in effect. So the part of the social disruption of the story is the attempt to say, this is the one important thing. And if you really think it's important, all these other things become, in some sense, secondary, in effect. Now, again, hard argument, but that's what she's saying. Yes, sir?
A couple times now you've drawn attention to the comedy in here that's happening at the same time as this violence and at the same time as this mystical grace. And earlier you drew the parallel with the crucifixion. Do you think O'Connor did she find something, a comedic element in the crucifixion of Jesus?
Yeah, it's a great question. There isn't a lot of evidence that she did in terms of her writing about the Bible and theology that I know of. But there's a guy with the wonderful name of Screech who has written a book about the comedy of the crucifixion who draws on her stories in part to elucidate this. So it's not there. It's not there in her discussion of theology so much, no. No, I would say the reason for that, this is a very nice question, thank you. I would say in part the reason for that is this is where the stylization of the stories come in. In other words, the crucifixion isn't comic, but our lives are incipiently comic because in some sense our lives are not nearly as serious as the crucifixion. And so, you know, part of the element of the comedic is to leaven the sense of importance of ourselves vis-a-vis all this, and to put it cheek to jowl with that sacramental moment. So it's something like that. But if you want to talk, but she's got a very strong sense of sacred history in the as the backdrop, and we don't need comedy there, we don't need grotesquerie there. It's the revelatory moment, something like that. So this is, if you want to put it this way, this is an analogia entis, right? That it's her way of negotiating, an analogy of being kind of thing, that it's an analogical imaginative act, that it's not the crucifixion, it's what the crucifixion can be for us.
Sure.
Is what she's trying to get at, I think. Does that help?
Yes.
Great. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think you might say that if a comedy is a story with a happy ending,
mm-hmm.
a commedia, mm-hmm. then, of course, the crucifixion would be a commedia because mm-hmm. it ultimately has a happy ending. And then I think it's important for her that it all works backwards. I mean, that there can't be a tragedy mm-hmm. in a truly Christian world because, in fact, ultimately, there can be no good deed which does not have its ultimate, does not reach its ultimate goal, even if it doesn't even happen in the world of secular consequences.
Mm-hmm. For what it's worth, I don't think that's actually the way O'Connor thinks about it. Because I think, and this isn't to say, I mean, the point you're making theologically is an important point. I'm not sure it's what O'Connor would say. Because O'Connor really does think this is all analogous. That is to say that the sacred history of the death and resurrection is the complete backdrop for this thing, but it's not this thing. And so there can be tragedies in this world. They're just, you know, the ending of the displaced person is, I think, at best, deeply, morbidly ironic. And there is no comic relief there. So I think she herself thinks that the possibility of tragedy is real. But what she worries about, I mean, she's writing with contemporaries who are very interested in the tragic, but they're all atheists, John Hawkes, Camus, people like that. And I think one of the things that drew her to the comic was the sense that it was the way to distance herself from that notion. But she doesn't think that these events are recapitulating the whole cycle of death and resurrection. She thinks it's, you know, what it is in the moment, in effect, which is a difficulty of it. I myself think it's one of the reasons she wrote stories better than novels. Because I think what she tries to do in the novels is she tries to capitulate the whole thing. And she's just not as, her art is not as, shall we say, attuned to that as it is to the moment. You know, I can get the moment anytime I want, and I can work it, as we'll see when we read the third story. So it's, I would, for what it's worth, I'm not sure she's convinced about that. But I don't know. Should we go to the third story? And because I wanted to, because we'll really see a change here, I think. This is Revelation. Now, I can't resist telling you that Revelation was finished while she was in a hospital bed in Atlanta in January of 1964. She snuck it into the hospital. She had a vicious onset of lupus, and it was pretty clear to her she was going to die from it. It was the third major episode of her life. She'd had minor ones, but she'd gotten to the point where she knew the disease, and she was pretty sure she wasn't going to make it. And they sent her to the hospital, and before they went, they said, "Now you can't do any work there." And she somehow managed to sneak in her drafts of Revelation and Parker's back and worked on them there. And the reason we know this is that Bob Giroux, her publisher, came to visit her in the hospital, and she gave them to him. And, you know, so she's in the hospital, and according to him, she had them under the pillow, and when they would go out, she would manage to get them out, and she had a pencil, and she was fixing the typescript, and then she'd slide it back. Anyway, so this is a story that's written when she is really in extremis, and she's about to die herself, and she's in awful health, and she thinks at one and the same time that it's very funny and not very nice. I mean, she talks about how the people in the hospital who care for her talk and talk and talk when she wants to sleep, and they increase her pain by about 1,000%, but they're funny, and she tells stories about what they're like. So she's living, in some sense, the kinds of things that she's described in terms of this mixing of the comic and death and whatnot. And in the midst of this, she writes this last part of this last story. And so I'd like you to hear it on its own terms, of course, but note how it evolves or shows some evolution. And we start with until. Good. Until the sun slipped finally behind the tree line, Mrs. Turpin remained there with her gaze bent to them. These are some sows in a pig pen that she's been looking at. As if she were absorbing some abysmal life-giving knowledge. At last she lifted her head. There was only a purple streak in the sky cutting through a field of crimson and leading like an extension of the highway into the descending dusk. She raised her hands from the side of the pen in a gesture hieratic and profound. A visionary light settled in her eyes. She saw the streak as a vast swinging bridge extending upward from the earth through a field of living fire. Upon it, a vast horde of souls were rumbling toward heaven. There were whole companies of white trash clean for the first time in their lives, and bands of black niggers in white robes, and battalions of freaks and lunatics shouting and clapping and leaping like frogs. And bringing up the end of the procession was a tribe of people whom she recognized at once as those who, like herself and Claude, had always had a little of everything and the God-given wit to use it right. She leaned forward to observe them closer. They were marching behind the others with great dignity, accountable as they had always been for good order and common sense and respectable behavior. They alone were on key. Yet she could see by their shocked and altered faces that even their virtues were being burned away. She lowered her hands and gripped the rail of the hog pen, her eyes small but fixed unblinkingly on what lay ahead. In a moment the vision faded, but she remained where she was, immobile. At length she got down and turned off the faucet and made her slow way on the darkening path to the house. In the woods around her, the invisible cricket choruses had struck up, but what she heard were the voices of the souls climbing upward into the starry field and shouting hallelujah. I have a hard time staying composed when I read that, but that's another thing. So, what's the moment of grace here? What do you think? There are earlier in the story, interestingly. There's
crazy black woman attacks her.
Yeah, we should have a little sidebar on this. This is quite wonderful. So the moment of violence in the story is when a woman named Mary Grace, and Mary Flannery O'Connor was called Mary Grace by her mother, by the way, is sitting in a doctor's office and furiously throws a book entitled Human Behavior at this woman, Ruby Turpin, and hits her in the eye. And then subsequently says, you know, go back to hell where you came from, you old warthog. And so when she's looking at the hogs in the pen, she's trying to figure out whether she's a warthog or not, in effect. So yeah, so the violence happens much earlier, and it's not lethal, right? Nobody dies. Hurrah, right? Yay, we're going in the right direction here. So that's different. So what's the moment of grace here at the end? It's a subtler thing, isn't it? What is it? What did you laugh at? What sentence made you laugh? I heard a number of you.
They alone were on key.
Yes, they alone were on key.
Yes, you can see by their shocked and altered faces that even their virtues seem burned away.
Yep, I think so. What's that all about? What does she see there? And we see it with her, right? Now, so we've gone from the grandmother, where we know the grandmother has seen something, to Mrs. May, who has a mystical vision that we can't, I mean, we know she's having, but we can't. And here, you know, this is, it's getting pretty explicit here. What does she see? Well, she sees people shriven. What? I'm sorry, yes? Yeah. Where's Mr. Franzen when we need him? What about the mystics and burning away virtues, huh? Anybody know about that? Part of mystical practice is, in fact, the steady diminishment of physical need, of, you know, anything that smacks of sort of the gratification of the body vis-a-vis the soul, right? I mean, you learn to calibrate your food and sleep and things like that to sustain yourself, but no more than that, because all of it pulls you away. So when we say shriven, the term shriven is really meant to be, you know, the experience of allowing the things that are unimportant to be removed. It's a kind of a human analog to the notion of kenosis with regard to Jesus, to the idea of the emptying out of self to do the service of God, in his case by making the sacrifice of his life, you know, in effect. But yeah, they're all, you know, getting them burned away. And are they surprised? Indeed they are. And I love the fact that they're on key. Why is that so funny? Why is it funny that they're on key? I mean, these are the people who sing in church and sing on key, right, Father Pat? These are, you know, we love these people because things fall apart if they don't do that stuff, right? But suddenly it doesn't seem to matter so much for Flannery O'Connor. I love the liturgy, I'm not. But I mean, for here, all that is suddenly irrelevant. Why?
Isn't there the implication that they came in last, my whole life, you were first?
Yes, definitely. And Ruby Turpin is obsessed with social hierarchy. One of the great things about this, I mean, I could talk about this story for hours, and we don't have hours, but she's throughout the story, she's trying to order people, and she has dreams at night, and the complexity of it bears in upon her. And, you know, there's the black doctor in town who drove a Cadillac and has, you know, 40 cattle, and how did he do that if he's supposed to be lower than me? And, you know, and behind this in her head is dreaming of boxcars and of Holocaust bodies. You know, she's seen the newsreel films coming out of World War II. So this is a woman who, your point is beautiful, because she's obsessed with social hierarchy, but she's troubled by it too. She can't figure it out. It doesn't quite work for her. She's smart enough to see that there's something artificial about it, even as she's compelled by it. So the shrivening at the end, where she and her people come at the end, of the shrivening at the end of the story, where she and her people come at the end of this, is significant. But what are they all in? Where are they going? They're going to heaven. Yeah, this is the heavenly procession, right? This is it. You know, we're on our way. And there we are. And then we have this nice little mix-up at the end. This is a source of great debate among Flannery O'Connor scholars, so look out, you all can contribute here. The invisible cricket choruses struck up, but what she heard were the voices of souls climbing upward in the starry field and shouting hallelujah. Now remember how we said earlier that there's this interesting combination of, on the one hand, local color, and on the other hand, transcendent claim. Big debate. Who hears the hallelujah chorus? I said it was just her, and people got very upset with me when I said that at a conference recently. But anyway, there's at least, whatever you think about that, this very interesting way in which she completes a circle that hasn't been completed here, because we get both the description of the world as it is. We get the crickets, and we get the hallelujah chorus at one and the same time. To my knowledge, the only time in anything she ever wrote where those two things are so symmetrically juxtaposed at the end. Boom. Crickets, but it's a hallelujah chorus. Hallelujah chorus, but it's crickets. And nobody dies.
So what was the debate? That
oh, the debate is whether the debate is...
that she was also hearing the crickets?
Yes, yes. They think that everybody can hear the hallelujah chorus. It's for everybody. And my worry about that is based in part on some things O'Connor said about the story. People thought Ruby Turpin was evil, including her editor, whom she loved. She was horrified. Her editor wrote her and said, I think Ruby Turpin is too mean and evil. She's like the devil. And she wrote this famous letter where she said, this is the problem I've been fighting my whole writing life. She's not the devil. I'm going to deepen her so no one can think she's the devil, because she's not. She's the one who gets the vision. You know, and so I'm influenced in part by that. I think she gets the vision, she hears the voice. And she says in another place she's a female Jeremiah. She could go on to great things. So, you know, I tend to think it's her. But I'm not sure how much it matters, actually. When I said big controversy, I was trying to rip the scholars in the sense I think sometimes we, as to quote Flannery O'Connor, we mince the pie a little too fine. I'm not sure it matters all that much, actually, but it is interesting that people get worked up about it. But yeah, but we have them both right there. Yes, sir.
Sorry. Just maybe connect something that isn't part of her self-deception, that she thinks she's a really happy person. I mean, she has, some lines in her eyes from smiling too much and stuff.
Yeah.
In fact, what she realizes that she's actually got deep anger, and so part of the things of these, the saved crew to which she belongs, are shocked, right? And so, I mean, the moment of salvation is not which they particularly chorus hallelujah.
Yeah.
I mean, they're sort of stunned that they're included in a larger body.
I think so. The only corollary I'd add to that, and I don't think it goes against the grain of what you're saying, but I think it may add a line that would please O'Connor, is I think Ruby Turpin is a happy person, but she's a troubled person. And part of what happens when Mary Grace, you know, have fun with it, yeah, she's from Wellesley College, hits her, is it brings some things into clarity for her. That to be told, not only to be hit by someone when you're being pleasant in a public place, but to be told, you know, you are a warthog from hell. It troubles her. It troubles her deeply. And when she talks to the help, and they see her with this black eye, and when she talks to her husband, they trot out the old, oh, you're not ugly, you're beautiful, and she knows it's BS. And so she's got this interesting... She is a happy person on the surface, but she has these dreams and things. So it's an interesting... So Ruby Turpin, unlike the grandmother and Mrs. May, both of whom live superficially, Ruby Turpin is more complicated about things. She's got more nuance about what's really going on and what words really mean and what actions really mean. But I think you're right that there's this deep desire to be nice and to make nice and to have things be comfortable and easy.
She's thanking God, isn't she? I mean, she's, I thank God for everything.
Yes, she does. Yes, that's right.
That's when she gets the look in the eye. So,
that's right. Yeah, yeah.
So what she's thanking him for is her good fortune.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And then she's...
Disrupted,
shall
we say.
In the revelation of
Well, you know, that's an interesting... It's interesting you put it that way, because she has to become a grouch to get the vision.
Yeah.
Right? You know, she has to become a grouch to get the vision. She doesn't go and get it if she is not. Yeah.
It just feels almost Pauline here. This, I mean, both the... She she's hit earlier in the text, and she's asking for that revelation from that girl. That's what she's told. You're going to go to hell, warthog.
Yeah.
And now, specifically to sort of see an upturning of expectation of social groups with regards to, you know, the... I love the line of... and battalions of freaks and lunatics shouting and clapping and leaping like frogs. These are the people who are leading the chorus up to the front. Completely defying sort of the social expectations.
Yeah. And it all doesn't matter because they're all going to heaven. Right. It just doesn't
matter. And she's not dead either.
No. She's watching it.
She continues, but now with this...
Well, and it's a vision. It's a vision, right? That's the other thing that's important to say. She goes home after this, right? Her life isn't over. And we're left to imagine what might be different. And, you know, this is, I'm a big fan of powers and limits of artistic work. I think, you know, an artist has certain powers, but there's always things that won't happen. And I think for Flannery O'Connor, what's next is not a question she's prepared to answer. What she's prepared to say is, if you take grace seriously, this is what it means. You know, but you want to look to her for an ethic? Good luck. You want to look to her with how we build the kingdom? Good luck. That's not what she's doing. Now, her defense of that is that everything hinges on grace. And nothing else matters but grace, ultimately. But she's not going to give you a full theology or an ethic to go with it, because that's just not what she's going to do. And the struggle of her novels, in my view, is the struggle with that. That what she's really about is that moment of grace and its consequences. So Hazel Motes at the end of Wiseblood, if you've read that or if you've seen the wonderful movie by John Huston, you know, Hazel Motes blinds himself and goes off, and that's really the only way she can get out of that story. You know, really. I mean, that's about what she can do, is the man who proclaims the church without Christ has to self-shriven, in effect. And so, you know, there's this wonderful, powerful vision that I think is very vital, but there's also a certain limit to it, and it's worth naming that as well. You know, it's not a full theological system, even though she loved theological systems, because she was convinced that there was something we were very much in danger of missing. Or underestimating, in fact. You see, I'm sorry I'm late. It's 7:35. I was told to be done by 7:30. But is it okay to... I mean, if there are other things people want to say, I don't have to go anywhere, but I also don't want to keep you if you were planning to leave. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.